We're hoping
it survives. The hospital told me that she has something to tell you.
Yes, hopefully. If it survives, it's...
Okay. Oh, thank you for coming again. Last time, we left off at a critical juncture. I also want to thank those who reached out with questions on the course of the week. I'm sorry that over the weekend we were in upstate New York. There still are places where there's not a lot of cell phone reception. So I'm sorry it was hard. You know who you are. It was hard to communicate. So I apologize about that. I'm looking forward to more questions and conversation discussion going forward. The last time we had a chance to have a partridge here, as it were, I had a chance to see that so much of the core of the halakhos that go on in the kitchen are rooted actually in Parshas Matos. And we tabled for now the discussion about the Tefillas Kelim. We may get to that next week. We'll see how timing works out. As an aside, if there's interest, I'm glad to go beyond the 3 weeks. We'll figure that out between now and next week. But we tabled for now the discussion about Tefillas Kelim. We jumped last time into the concepts that lie behind Kasher and Kelim, which is the other major discussion in the Psukim and Parshas Matos. And that brought us again, you may remember, to a discussion about the core idea of Tam Ke'ikar, that the whole notion of Kasher and Kelim to remove the absorbed flavor presumes a basic concept, that the halacha cares about absorbed flavor. You know, we care not only about the ikar, the actual chunks of food, we also care about a food which in and of itself is neutral, is fine, but is carrying with it absorbed trace of flavor, so that presents a problem. Either flavor went straight from the bacon into the potatoes, or the flavor went from the bacon into the pan, and then subsequently go from the pan, step two, into the potatoes, both of those are problematic. So much so, if you want to use the pan for kosher food, you better make sure to somehow remove all those bacon flavors before you use it for kosher food, so that the kosher food remain kosher. So we had a chance to talk last time, sort of about to get comfortable with the core concept of Tam Ke'ikar, not just as treif, but sort of to isolate, to think about it. And last time we also had a chance to take a look and to think together about two of the dimensions of Tam Ke'ikar. One dimension of Tam Ke'ikar were the different methods of Tam transfer, the big one being heat. We also spoke about the 24-hour soak. We spoke about a sort of just absorption, a spongy, well-cooked piece of meat absorbing liquid, as well as the double sharp, right? A sharp food, spicy food, together with a sharp tool. There's one major dimension with the different ways that Tam can be transferred. If you don't have any method of Tam transfer, so then all you have to do is just make sure everything is clean and move on. There is a method of Tam transfer, so as I said last time with our salvo, and then there may or may not be a problem. The second dimension of Tam we raised was the issue of quantity. Sometimes the whole issue is flavor. So if you have trace of flavor that's mixed into something that's neutral and it's diluted to the point where you have less than one part in 60, so then batel b'shisha. So little bacon in the chicken soup, in the whatever it may be, or a large pot of water with a little bit of tarfus, it's so little trefa ingredient in the mass of kosher stuff, if it's batel b'shisha, is diluted, it's not enough to make an impact in terms of flavor. And by the way, as an aside, just on the topic of shishim, 60 sounds like an awful lot. But just a way to visualize it, to realize that shishim isn't really so much, is to remember that, if you can visualize this, people are visual learners more than others, so you think about sort of like blocks, sort of stacking blocks. So imagine you have a cube of 4 blocks by 4 blocks, a square, right, 4 by 4, and you make that into a cube, 4 by 4 by 4. Right, not so much. That's already 4 times 4 times 4 is 64. So you think about one block out of shishim. That's already shishim. So shishim sounds 60 sounds like a tremendous amount. How can you have like 60 times? How can a pot contain 60 times as much total content as the piece of felon? But it's not really so much. If the piece was like this, the piece of trefus is like this, the total pot is like that, and it's full, you probably have shishim. It's not that's so big. So that's a hold up for a moment. I will take questions in a moment. That's just sort of recapping what we spoke about last time. Hagalas Kalim, Kashrin Kalim, as a source for the concept of Tom Kicker, and got us into, we were about to talk about Hagalas Kalim, and we had a very rich, not just from a narrative perspective, also from a halachic perspective, a very rich situation that was raised, practice situation with the salad bowl, which got us talking about sort of these dimensions of Tom Kicker, thinking about different ways that Tom can be transferred, and thinking about the dilution. Now we're going to jump for a moment. We left off last time was let's actually talk about how you kasher kalim. We're going to get to that in just a couple of moments. That's five easy steps, and then we'll unpack that. Before we do that, I just want to talk about one key meta halachic point, one very important point that it's relevant to kashrus, relevant to a lot of areas, but particularly kashrus. And I think it'll maybe diffuse some anxieties that I might have inadvertently, unintentionally produced last time. And that is the difference between, here's another set of terms that get bandied about a lot, so let's actually understand what they mean, and you'll see they're pretty useful for the way we think about halacha. The difference between bidi'eved and lechatchila. So sometimes, or in common parlance, they're misused, fine, but if you like, the way they're used in Yiddish, lechatchila is like the best way to do things, and bidyevah is sort of like the okay way to do things. Lechatchila is sort of like mahadrin, and bidyevah is like non-mahadrin. So that's not exactly correct. There is such a concept as mahadrin, non-mahadrin, but lechatchila bidyevah is important. Rabbi Neuberger would want in his shiurim to point out that the proper pronunciation of the word bidyevah is actually bidyavad, which is Aramaic for bishe'asa, if you already did it. If you did it already, see, here's what you do. Bidi'eved, bidi'avad, really means post facto. Okay, I shouldn't, so simple example. You're not supposed to stick milk spoons into fleshic pots of food. L'chatchila, techila means the beginning, right? So if you ask me before the act, should I do this? The answer is no, don't do it. Absolutely don't do it. But just because you shouldn't do it doesn't mean that if you did it, you know, the sky is falling. So the answer afterwards, maybe, and we'll get later today to some situations that might be the case. B'diavad, you already stuck the spoon into the pot. Now your question is the food tray for the pot tray for the spoon tray? Should I throw out my kitchen? The answer is definitely don't throw out your kitchen, and the food may be fine, and the pot may be fine. Maybe not. We'll have to figure that out. But there's a difference. Sometimes the food does have to go in the garbage. Sometimes the spoon and the pot do have to be kashered, or they can't be kashered. We'll get that soon. But sometimes everything's fine. Or sometimes some of them are fine. So those are two separate, both valid questions, but two separate questions. L'chatchila means batchila, in the beginning, a priori. Should I do X or should I not do X? And b'diavad is, now that X has happened, how do I pick up the pieces? So b'diavad is once things have happened, what do I do now? L'chatchila is before, and may I do this? And then there's sort of the even earlier step, what we could call protocol. So sometimes you want to run a kitchen in an efficient, smooth way. Let me give an example that's not even halachic. You could, in theory, you know, as you're making supper or as you're making Shabbos, you could, in theory, as you make every dish, take whatever you just use and clean it, take it to the sink and clean it and put it aside and now start the next thing. You could if you want to. It's extremely inefficient. It's usually a lot more efficient to do whatever you're doing and make a mess, and then an hour or two later, when you're all done, you put everything in the sink and you wash it. Either one is fine. Forget about halacha. Either one is fine. This is a point of view of efficiency. You probably will prefer, unless you're so echoed by a single dirty spoon. Usually, just from a point of view of efficiency, it would be a reasonable protocol. The way you run your kitchen typically is get everything dirty and then clean it. It's just an efficient protocol. Either one works. Either one will result in a clean kitchen. Usually you just have a certain protocol of how things run to make things run best. And that has nothing to do with halacha whatsoever. Sometimes you can have a protocol for how you run your kitchen that has to do with halacha, but it doesn't mean that if you don't follow the protocol, anything went wrong. It's just a smoother way to run things. So for example, last time I mentioned that if you stuck used the wrong milk, the wrong denomination of Boland's food for cold. Like he realized, I mentioned I went to some other community and scholar residence, and the first morning for breakfast I thought I would end up taking a Fleishig bowl and Fleishig spoon and had my Cheerios and milk. So as I mentioned, the best way to handle it is take it to the kitchen sink. You take it to the bathroom sink and just wash in cold water and soap, and then you're good to go. So someone said, well, how about if you do it in the Fleishig sink? It's probably fine also. And I wasn't saying that it's awesome to do it in the kitchen sink. It's just, as a matter of protocol, the simplest way to run things is if things get dirty with the wrong type, assuming you don't have to kasha or anything, so then just as a matter of protocol, it's usually a simpler protocol to just know if things are mixed, you're going to wash them in the bathroom. So it's not a problem with the effort. It's not even a problem with chatchilah, usher. It'll just be a lot simpler to just always, and we'll see that often. We're about to jump in now into how to kasha. Once again, there are other ways to do it, but the following five steps are a simple protocol to follow. The Gemara gives advice as we enter the world of Haggadah. The Gemara gives advice not about Haggadah. Haggadah, once again, is the process of kashering, of removing the absorbed flavors through boiling hot water. The Gemara has a general principle about learning Torah. The principle is Ligras v'hadr lispar. If you care to spell that, and once again, I'm sorry, I don't have to try to forward. I feel very writing impaired here. But ligras is lama yud gimel reish samach. That means a person ought to absorb information. V'hadar, and then lisbar, lama yud samach beis reish. Then a person ought to try to understand it more deeply. Sometimes it pays to sort of get down the data before you try to analyze it and understand why. Or to use Thomas Kuhn's terminology for those from that field. We're going to go for description first and then for explanation. So first let's describe the data. Here are the facts. I'll tell you first the five steps. In a typical case, five steps to kosher kli, and then afterwards we can sort of unpack them, and they have a lot, there's a lot going on behind these five steps that will be helpful to understand Haggadah, and some will be helpful to understand kashrus in general. But first, in a typical case where something became treif in a pot. So let's say you had chicken soup made in a Fleishig pot, so far so good. And the person who made the chicken soup knew what she or he was doing, and the chicken soup was made in a Fleishig pot with Fleishig tools. And everything was clean in the Fleishig sink, and so far so good. And the chicken soup is boiling happily, simmering happily on the stovetop. Someone comes along, and he or she decides to help him or herself to some chicken soup and takes a handy ladle and spoons out some chicken soup. The problem is that the handy ladle was milk. Okay. So then that misstep was discovered. Hopefully everyone handles that misstep calmly and rationally. And we say, okay, we have a problem, and let's figure out what to do. So as I mentioned last time, today's starting idea was about protocol. Last time, starting idea was asking shaylos. Please feel free to ask shaylos. Please feel free to call me or whichever local qualified halachic authority you care to ask, and feel free to ask shaylos. So you say, this doesn't look ideal, this looks like a problem, let's call. So almost definitely you will have to kosher that label. The pot, maybe not, the soup maybe not, we'll get to that. But at least you stuck a milchik ladle into a Fleishig pot of boiling hot chicken soup, you got to kasher the ladle. And the ladle is probably kasherable. If a ladle is made out of ceramic, so you cannot kasher it. Or if the ladle has loads of cracks, the ceramic gets a pasuk in chumash. Ceramic is so porous, typically you can never fully pull everything out. Or if a ladle is just so old and worn, has so many cracks and crevices that there is so much food in it, and you can never really clean it, then you can't kosher. But your typical metal, hard, dishwasher-safe plastic ladle, or something made out of rubber, probably not a ladle, but something made out of metal, or rubber, or dishwasher-safe plastic, or wood, those are all, most materials except for ceramic are trashable. If you're glass, it gets a little complicated. Depends on your Ashkenazi or Sephardi. Other than the ceramic and glass, almost everything else is kosherable. Plastic, as an aside, for Pesach, Moshe Feinstein writes that for Pesach we have a minhag to avoid. With Pesach we have a number of chumras. Whatever chumras is, the plastic is new material for Pesach. We just buy new plastic. We don't kosher plastic. But all year long, the milchus fleishik kosher treif, all year, every day, all year long koshering, you can kosher plastic the same way you can kosher metal and rubber and wood. And here we'll take one question from the back, and then we'll jump into five steps.
What happens if the label is made out of two components, one that you can kosher, and one that's not kosherable? Sometimes you have utensils that will have, let's say, enough plastic or ceramic or plastic, or wood.
That's a great question. The great question is worth asking. It sometimes is salvageable, especially if the ceramic part, if you're certain the ceramic part never was contacted with the food. So let's say if you have some ornamental porcelain piece at the end of the handle, that's not going to be a problem. If the ceramic is in a spot where it may have come in contact with food, then you may have a problem. So it's worth asking.
What about wood?
Wood is kosher. Absolutely. Yeah. Again, wood sometimes, you have to look at a wooden cutting board, so it may be so grooved that it's impossible to clean. And step number one of the five steps is you first have to clean it. So let's say if you have something that's very worn and grooved, or let's say you have a sieve or a sifter, or cause sometimes things like that, they have a lot of tiny crevices, they're just not cleanable. In principle, it should be, let's say you have a wooden spoon, mixing spoon. So that's a kosher. So what are the five steps? And then we'll take more questions. Again, in general, the five steps are, number one, you want to clean it well. And number two, you want to let it sit. Typically, you want to let it sit for at least 24 hours. Once it's clean, let it sit for 24 hours. Number three, after it's been cleaned and has sat for 24 hours, now you're ready to actually kosher. So step three is you take a pot of water, a pot that's large enough to fit this thing inside. Let's say you're koshering a ladle. So let's say you're probably not going to take a tiny saucepan. You take a soup pot, and you fill up a pot with water, and bring it to boil, and go do something else, because it will take time for water to boil, whether you watch it or not.
Which pot?
Great question. Great question. So the truth is, as long as the pot, the typical thing people do is the type of pot, the denomination that this is becoming. So let's say if it was a milchig ladle and it became fleishig, you want to bring it back to milchig, usually people prefer to use a milchig pot. But the truth is, as long as the pot has sat, itself has sat for 24 hours, it really doesn't matter that much. But you wouldn't want to use a pot that was used that morning for fleishig, you wouldn't want to use. So step number one is clean the ladle. Step number two is let the ladle sit overnight, and not let it sit for 24 hours. Step number three is boil your pot of water, bring it to a nice rolling boil. When it reaches a rolling boil, step number four is immerse your ladle in the pot, which can go in one of two ways. If you really have a big pot, let's say you're doing a spoon, you're koshering a spoon, so you can just let it, just drop it and let it fall to the bottom. If you're doing a ladle, it may be hard to find the pot big enough. Right? Usually ladles are big enough that they don't fit the pot. That's how ladles are made. So, but unlike toveling, when you tovel, you need the entire item, person or item, whatever, toveling yourself or toveling the item, tovel has to be the entirely in one shot. Koshering is because toveling is a spiritual process. It just works. It works metaphysically. So it has to be simultaneous. Koshering is a physical process. You're actually removing flavor from the. So when you kosher, if you want to, you can do it all at once, or if you want to, you can do in parts. Let's say, for instance, you just have to make sure that over the course of all your dips, every spot on what you're koshering gets touched. So, for instance, you have a ladle. So you have a little soup, a little saucepan, and you're never going to be able to get the middle in. But if you have a big pot, so you stick the ladle in 60%, then take it out with mitts, obviously, and then stick it to the other end, 60%. Everything is covered, that's fine. Whenever you stick it in, here again, step four of the immersing in the boiling hot water, if you when you stick something cold into a pot of boiling hot water, you may stop the boiling. You don't need an advanced degree in thermodynamics to figure that one out. Especially if you're sticking something big. There's something that just cools the water down a little bit. So you just leave it in there long enough for the boiling. If you stick, just drop a fork in. So, okay.
It goes for a while.
Well, right, exactly. If you pour a lot of, pour it, after a while, you throw in one fork, another fork, another fork, another fork. After a while, it may stop boiling. So just wait for the boiling to resume and then continue. Or let's say you have a ladle. You stick one end of the ladle and the boiling sort of stops. So just hold it there for a couple seconds. The boiling resumes. Once it resumes, pull it out. Do the other half. Boiling stops. You hold it there. It resumes. And now you pull it out. And now you're up to, you've completed 4 out of 5 steps. And the fifth step is, after you're done with immersing it, you rinse the item in cold water. And now you are done. So once again, the five steps to kosher kli are clean it. I guess step 0 is make sure this is an item that you can kosher. That's not ceramic. Glass you have to ask about, and obviously it's cleanable. And step 1 is clean. Step 2 is wait 24 hours. Step 3 is boil your water. And make sure you have a nice rolling boil. Step number 4 is immerse it. And once again, wait for the, and hold it long enough for the boiling to resume. And so step number 5 is your cold rinse. Yeah?
Do these have to be intentional steps? Let's say, I'm back to my bowl. You clean it, mommy cleans it, and then it sits in the cabinet for 3 weeks. Now can I go and kosher it?
Absolutely.
Like I don't have to say back then, I'm doing this to kosher it.
Ah, good. So you want to know, see here, great. You're kind of questioned the example of the fact I said before, ligros far delispero, well, description and explanation. I said to figure out applications, we'll have to understand a little bit of why. So the short answer to your question is, right, you don't have to, it doesn't have to be an intentional process. In general, as I said before, kashering, unlike tevila, kashering is really a physical process. So it's not intent is not that important as long as you know that things were done correctly. Sometimes you didn't really mean it. Let's say if you actually did the actual kashering itself, you just sort of, tossed it in or something to a boiling pot of hot water for fun, I'm not sure why it's fun. But there, you may just be worried that you didn't really do it, but if you weren't focused on the halakhic process, you may not have done it properly. But yeah, weighing 24 hours is weighing 24 hours. Anyway, you slice it, it doesn't, you don't have to have havana, though. Now I'm talking about 24 hours. That's a good question. The question is why? Why does intent not matter? It really goes back to let's figure out why these steps are what they are. But first, let's take some more questions.
Have you then trafed up the water, so to speak? I mean, can you then either kosher other things or maybe even cook pasta?
Amazing question. Have you trafed up the water? Hold on that question. We'll get back to it very soon. Yeah.
Hi. I have another question. Sure. So you said to immerse it. How long are you immersing?
Once the water is boiling again, it doesn't require a second. You just have to wait for the boiling to start again, and you can pull it up.
If something's too big, can you pour you pour boiling water over the sink or whatever.
Ah, okay. So something's too big. Right. Something's too big. So we'll get soon to the pouring water onto something doesn't always work. We'll get to that in a little bit. Usually, if something is too big, let's say the chicken soup. Let's say sometimes the response to the milchig ladle in the chicken soup will be the ladle has to be kosher, but the chicken soup is fine pasta. That's one common response. The other response, which happens sometimes, is your ladle is a problem, and your chicken soup is a problem, and your pot's a problem. So the chicken soup is a problem. You can give it to a friendly non-Jewish neighbor. There's not much you can do. You can't kosher food. You can kosher both your ladle and your pot. So now the question is, how am I going to kosher my pot? The ladle was easy. But if I have an even larger pot, great. But your chicken soup pot often is your largest pot. That's why it's your chicken soup pot. So how do you kosher the chicken soup pot? So that what you typically do there is it will be its own kosher pot. Right? That's exactly, I see a woman with experience. So the way you do that is everything the same. You clean it, let's sit 24 hours. You boil it up, you fill it with water, you boil it, and now it's boiling. So now the water in the pot is removing all the flavor from the pot. The one issue is, and then afterwards you're going to rinse it with cold water. The only difference is, poskim write, that we said before, you need to get total immersion of all the surfaces. So the one surface that's not being covered, that's not being treated, is the rim of the pot. Now you get the rim kosher. Because sometimes stuff may have splashed over, hit the top. So how do you take care of that? So the, what they say is, you want to get the water, put something in, Archimedes, right? Put something in, the water will flow over, which is great. Here's the problem. So, exactly, I'm going to put something cold, I'm going to take a rock and drop a cold rock and drop it in, so it'll you know, I could take a little pot or something else and dip it in, but that'll cool down the water. So what you need to do is, you need to put something in that's boiling hot. So how do you do that? So in the old days, in Shulchan Aruch, they describe, again, if you have a, I guess this works better if you have a fireplace, you have like a rock that's in heat. And I guess if you have a fireplace, it's not hard. You leave a rock in the fireplace, and then it'll be boiling hot, and you take it with tongs, and you stick it into the boiling pot of hot water, and everything just...
So you could just boil two pots and then take the smaller
exactly.
pot.
So nowadays, unless you happen to have a handy fireplace, I usually recommend exactly. Take a smaller kosher chicken soup pot, and while that's boiling, take a kettle or a little pot, boil that also. So you know that that's also a 212. And then, once the chicken soup pot is boiling, take the other pot, dunk it in, and that itself is not going to cool down the water because it's boiling too, and it makes the water flow over. Turn off the gas very quickly. Before your water puts out the gas, just practical safety point. And finally, everything cooled down, rinse with cold water. Yeah.
And wipe up the mess.
And wipe up the mess. So ideally, try to do this gently with minimal. There's no mitzvah to mop the floor after kasher. It sometimes happens, but you can try to be careful and minimize it. Yeah.
You put the pot into the pot, the bigger pot, or you just pour the water in?
Probably better to put the pot itself in. Again, at least as a matter of pro, again, if you didn't, it doesn't mean all is lost in your kitchen, right? But it's probably simpler and more straightforward to just dip it in.
Why is that?
Why not put in more water?
So that's a good question, which maybe takes us back to what you were asking, which is I've been assuming that we have, the kasher is happening in a pot of boiling hot water. Mm-hmm. So why am I assuming that? How about when we kasher your sink for Pesach, so you don't boil the sink? Besides the fact that would be possible, it's not necessary. All you do is just boil a kettle and pour it over the sink. So wouldn't that be so much simpler? We have to boil a pot and stick a ladle in both ways. Just boil or the chicken soup pot, just boil a kettle. So the answer to that is the following. I said in general, here's what you do. Right? Sometimes you do get to do it a little easier, and sometimes you have to do it a little more intensely. Because what the Torah tells us, this goes back to the pasuk last week, Sedron, in Parshas Matos, Torah says, well, the one thing the Torah is clear about when it comes to kashering is that the method they use to kasher corresponds to how it became trade from the first place. The way that the flavor went in is the way the flavor is going to come out. Or to use a Hebrew term, kibolo kach polto. The way it's swallowed is the way you're going to get it to spit it out. The Torah says, if you used it, and we touched on this last time, a little bit now, right, to sort of dive into that more. The Torah says, if you used it with dry heat, directly on the fire, let's say a grill or a spit or something like that, or a frying pan, if you're just pan frying, so it's basically dry heat, that's more intense. The only way to get that flavor out, typically, is with dry heat, directly in the fire, libun, throw it into a self-cleaning oven, or make a really hot fire by there, perhaps a blowtorch, if that works. But that's extreme. It doesn't come up that often. It will sometimes come up with frying pans. Other than that, it'll come up with grills. But the Torah says that's the most of it. If the flavor went in very intensely, the only way to get it out is through equally intense method, parallel method, with heat, with dry heat, libun. But the Torah says if it went in less intensely, it didn't go in through direct dry heat, it went with wet heat, like a ladle in chicken soup. If you were cooking, there was liquid involved, so then it went in less intensely, it can come out with less intense methods as well. You can use Haggadah, you can use boiling hot water. There's an even lower level, where it went in very non-intensely, and therefore it can come out more non-intensely. Because the chicken soup pot, and those who have spent time learning Hilchos Shabbos will be familiar with this concept. Same concept, a similar concept in Shabbos and in Kashrus. The ladle, the case I gave before, the ladle, you suck the ladle in to the chicken soup pot. The chicken soup pot is actually heated from the fire. Right? The chicken soup was on the fire, and the soup is hot in the pot that he was heating in. a possible, the thing that was actually on the fire is called a kli rishon. So obviously chicken soup is hotter in the chicken soup pot than it's going to be in the bowl. Right? Because it gets into the bowl isn't hot, the bowl is cold, chicken soup hits the bowl, it begins to cool down. So if you imagine pouring chicken soup, say a little pot, you pour it directly from your pot into your bowl, so the bowl is, the pot is the kli rishon, it's your first kli, the one that was actually on the fire, and the bowl is your kli sheni, the second place where the chicken soup and has chicken soup second home, and there already it's starting to cool down. It may still be hot, but for those who are kashless minded, it may be hot, but the temperature is now dropping. So it's not as bad in the area of Hilchos Shabbos, it's also not as bad in the area of kashrus. So, and there's the in-between is where you're pouring, right? You're pouring from, so let's think about a sink for a moment. So the reason why you don't have to actually boil up your sink or somehow take your sink and stick it into a pot of boiling hot water into a kli rishon, to kasher in a kli rishon in the boiling pot of hot water, is because the sink never absorbed via kli rishon. You didn't have a fire under your sink. All that happened is the water was coming out of the faucet, sort of like pouring from the kli rishon onto the sink. So the worst that happened is that you had milk with fleshy, you had chametz, let's say, flowing around your sink all year long, and there was hot water coming out of the tap, hitting the sink and the chametz. So the worst that happened was it was being poured on from a kli rishon. It was that lower level of heat. So that's why it's sufficient to use that lower level of heat to kasher. So let's say so that's why it's enough to boil your kettle is a kli rishon, you boil the kettle, and then you pour it onto the sink. So let's say, as an example, let's say you had you used the fleishig ladle for the chicken soup, but then you ladled soup into a bowl, and the bowl was milchik. Right? You didn't stick the bowl into the chicken soup pot. The bowl was never in a kli rishon. It got poured onto it. So in that case, all you need to do, you wouldn't need to stick the bowl into a pot. You could if you want to, but you also have the right to just pour from a kettle onto the bowl because that's the way it became trained.
So what in a salad bowl, which you would never cook, would you pour onto that to
wooden salad bowl that you never cook in.
You can't because it's wooden, so you can't put it right. In the fire.
But the problem was just the soaking.
Well, the problem was possibly
the only way it absorbed to begin with was the
vinegar.
Possible soaking.
Right.
I believe, I don't remember for sure, that's sort of like out of this, that's not really heat at all, it's a different one. I believe in that case you can also use Iri kli rishon, I believe. That you can, it's enough to pour from the kettle. I believe, yeah. I'm not sure, I would want to check up and get back to it.
What about like, or was it supposed to flush?
Do you mind?
Yeah,
she's my mother, I can do that. Okay, what about like, koshering an oven, but like the key feature is it doesn't have a self-cleaning mode.
Okay.
So that's like old people love it. Like in my mom's day.
Look, when I was growing up in the days of Abraham Lincoln, I
didn't have them. Those of us that live in the Heights still have them.
Right, yes.
She's going to school and they're going to have a non-self-cleaner.
Right.
So
yeah, so the ovens are sort of interesting because, okay, there's the long version and then there's the short version and there's a really short version. The really short version is what you want to do, the Moshe Feinstein looks at ovens, is you're going to want to clean thoroughly. That's probably going to be the hardest part of the whole process. Depends on who was there before. You're going to want to clean it pretty thoroughly, because once again, cleaning without, kosher without cleaning is really sort of pointless. You want to clean it really thoroughly, and then you let it sit for 24 hours. It may have already sat for a while since the last time it was used. And then, as Moshe Feinstein says, that you know that it didn't get any higher than whatever the top temperature is, so you have the right to just leave it at that, leave it where 450, 500, where the top temperature is, for a half hour, 45 minutes, and then you let it cool down, you're done. And that's
probably
that's
easier.
Yeah.
That's probably easier than
what you said. Maybe I would love to take more questions. I just want to go back first to we spoke about five steps. I just want to sort of unpack them and a little bit, sort of get the basic concepts that come from them, and then we'll be ready for. Wow. We're ready to stop. Oh my. Okay. And then we'll talk about where we're headed next time. And I'd be glad to stick around for some more questions as well. So again, the five steps for kashering are, assume that's an item you can kasher. If you need to do kli rishon, kashering in the kli rishon, you're going to clean it, wait 24 hours, boil up that water, immerse, or if you don't need to immerse, you can pour onto, right? One or the other. And then finally, when everything is cool and safe, you're going to rinse it in cold water. Now let's talk a little bit about why. Ligros Madulispa, ready for the explanation. So in terms of the steps 3 and 4, the boiling the water and the immersing, so that's what we're talking about, right? And Kari Matos tells us the concept of Tamka Iker. Matos also tells us the concept of Kabolo Kampolto, that the way it went in is the way it's going to come out. That's sufficient to remove the flavor. Okay. And now, step 5, with the cold water rinse, is a deep, dark mystery. Why it is the Rishon already are trying to figure out. 800 years are trying to figure out. We know that we rinse afterwards, and we're not 100% sure why. A number of theories were put forward over the centuries. The one that sort of captured my imagination the most is, and I think is very inspiring, which is not something you often think about in kitchen kasher, Rabbi, but one ought to. Menachem Gannett, the Rav in Englewood, of Shomer Emuna in Englewood, and is the CEO of OU Kashrus, he also gives Yoredei Shir for the speaker program at YU. And I remember when I took his in his shir, see, he mentioned a fascinating possibility, which is that kashering kalim actually appears in two places in Chumash. It appears in Parshas Matos, in the context of we have treifa utensils used to belong to non-Jews, how do we make them kosher? It also appears in Parshas Tzav, beginning of Chumash Vayikra, in the context, a very different type of context. You're in the Beis HaMikdash, and you cook carbon meat, and you eat them, which is wonderful. The problem is that carbonos expire. And if you let them go for the pan of the carbon for beyond the first day or two, you're not allowed to eat them, which is fine. Eat up the carbon. But what do you do with the pots? Right? The meat was kosher, but tomorrow morning that meat is treif. So even if you eat up all the meat, let's say you had a carbon Pesach. Right? So you roasted your carbon Pesach on a spit. You had a carbon chatas, Tara says. So you cooked the carbon chatas, you grilled it, you cooked it, whatever it was, and you ate it all up that night. Great. Nothing left the next morning. But how about the pots? They have absorbed the flavor of the carbon chatas, which last night was kosher, but this morning is treif, because the carbon expires. It's an interesting sort of idea. So what do you do with the pots? So the Torah says that they kosher the pots, but there it's more than just sort of a matter of practicality, necessity. It's actually a mitzvah. It's special as a procedure for a ritual. One of the mitzvahs of the Beis HaMikdash is the pot kosher. It actually had to happen, the whole parak and Masechet Zvachim, in part dedicated to these, I think, 10th parak, 11th parak, dedicated in part to these halachas. And it was done in the Beis HaMikdash specifically, and in addition to boiling in hot water to remove the flavor, the Torah says, Morak v'shutaf b'moy. You would boil in hot water, then rinse it in cold water. But not to remove anything, that was part of the mitzvah. After you use hot water, you do cold water dip. So Rabbi Ganek suggested that it could be that as a fulfillment of the notion of Zecher and Mikdash, whenever we do a mitzvah there are many mitzvahs that were done in the Beis HaMikdash, which we have found ways of either required midrabanan or mini Yisrael has developed ways of commemorating those mitzvahs. Yirmiyahu, Gemara Rosh Hashanah, at the beginning of the fourth paragraph of Rosh Hashanah, where he quotes Pasuk in Yirmiyahu. Tzion hi doresh ein lah. Yirmiyahu complains that, look, Tzion is over there and no one is paying attention. And it's terrible. The Gemara says, apparently, we ought to do things to make sure that Tzion is in front of our minds. And one of the ways we do that is to find ways to replicate mitzvahs that were done in the Beis HaMikdash. Chadlokas Neris Chanukah is probably in part a Zeichel. The fact that we shake lulav on Chol Moed Sukkos, That was only done with the Beis HaMikdash after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. We have from said we could do it all over the world to remember what was done. And there are a number of such examples. So Rabbi Ganak suggests it could be that when you kosher, the hot water does the trick, but the cold water is Eichon HaMikdash. It's sort of sounds like a fasting idea, like especially Pesach time. But all year long. Like, I don't know, like a tray for spoon, a tray for, you know, seems like so technical. And then the hot water, and it's just like you have your gloves, you're making sure you have safety first, right? And it's sort of like, it seems very steamy, literally. Everything, your glasses are steamed up, everything's just messy, and there's water on the floor. And, like, you do, it seems like you're just sort of doing what you have to do. And in the midst of that all, you sort of take a moment to remember the Beis HaMikdash. Like, this is sort of the same way that the a series of mitzvahs, among them, Sefer Rosh Chala, the Hiratzah, she brought a Beis HaMikdash. We say in conjunction, whenever we do it, a mitzvah that where there's a mikdash element, so we sort of remember, like, sort of to see beyond the moment. So very powerful. Like, kashrus sometimes seems very technical, and it does have a lot of technical details, but there's, from the technical details, you can't lose the forest for the trees. You have to take care of all the trees, but there's also, you have to sometimes take a moment to step back and see the forest. Now, in terms of that, let's just wrap up in the next minus 60 seconds. Then we'll pick up the Mirtz Hashem next week. So we understand why we need to boil the water and immerse it. We understand why afterwards we're immersing cold water, perhaps Zeich HaMikdash. We understand why step one was to clean it, because if it's dirty, so then it doesn't. If your ladle is still covered with dried chicken soup and you stick it into the boiling pot of hot water to kosher it, well, the chicken soup is just going to get right back into the ladle again, right? You're not accomplishing anything. Which is also, we have this to close, the reason for your 24-hour lag time. Why are we waiting for 24 hours? It's treif, clean it, kosher it. Remove the flavor and move on. What do you have to wait 24 hours for? So the answer there is really, you had raised that question before. Tosis, right? You found Tosis' question. Tosis, I don't understand this koshering business. I don't get this. Right? How did the ladle become fleishig in the first place? Because you stuck it into a pot of boiling chicken soup. So I don't understand. You're now going to take it and stick it in the pot of boiling hot water. Right? But it already has chicken soup flavor in it. So you stick it in the boiling hot water, chicken soup flavor migrates out into the water. Why can't it migrate back in? It's in boiling water. Right? If there was a piece of chicken floating in the pot and you stuck in a ladle, well, that would become fleishig. So if there's chicken soup flavor in the pot, in the ladle, it goes out into water. What? The flavor knows, oh, I was just here, better not go back? Is there some Maxwell's demon is there saying that you've been here one time, you're done? Like, what's going on? The Tosa says, I don't know, maybe it does. Maybe like it's sort of like, the Tosa's trying to like, what? The Tosa is a very vigorous action. Can it be? Like the it doesn't bounce back? Like, does that make sense? Doesn't make sense. Tosis works on this problem for a while. So ultimately what they say is, as a matter of protocol, if you wait 24 hours, you know you're safe. Why? And here we close with an important concept. Flavor, it sits in a kli, in a utensil, in a pot, in a pan, in a fork. When it sits there for 24 hours, it stops being active. It sits for 24 hours in the metal, it sort of picks up the metallic taste, the plasticky taste, and it wherever it will go afterwards, it will be a net negative. It will not be adding fine chicken soup flavor. It will be mostly adding metallic, yes, very slight, but the net result will be net. The chicken soup flavor is also very slight. It will be a net negative. So that's why, in general, with very few exceptions, once a flavor is absorbed in a utensil for more than 24 hours, it's no longer active. So if you stick your chicken soup ladle, if it's already waited 24 hours, but then you stick in the boiling pot of hot water, it goes into the water, yeah, and they come back, that's fine, I don't care. Once it's 24 hours old, it can't make anything else treif. So that's why, for instance, and we close with this, the most common application, we call that, by the way, the Hebrew term is, within 20, if the flavor has been in the utensil for less than 24 hours, if it's still within the first day, we call it ben yomo. It's within the first day. It's still alive and active blia, like you get yogurt, live and active cultures. So within the first day, if the flavor has been lingering in the pot or the spoon for less than 24 hours, it's still alive and active, and it can impact other things. Once it's lingered there for more than 24 hours, it can't impact anything else. So that's why we'll close with this. I said before, when you stick, you have the shayla, well, I stuck my milchik ladle into the fleshik chicken soup, what do I do? I said, often, the answer is, a ladle needs to be kosher, but your chicken soup is fine, your pot's fine. How could that be? Either it's okay, it's not okay. The answer is very simple. The chicken soup is chicken soup. The pot is obviously fleshik in a ben yomo way. It has the chicken soup in it right now. But that milchik ladle, how milchik is your milchik ladle? So if it was used for hot milchiks in the last 24 hours, well then you got a real problem on your hands, because it's a live and active milchik blia is going to go make the chicken soup treif. It's going to go make the fleshik pot treif, and obviously chicken soup will make the ladle treif.
That's a good point.
We'll have to think, maybe it's batul b'shishim, we'll have to think about it. More often than not, when was the last time you used your milchik ladle for hot milchiks? I don't know. Last time we had, so it depends. Some people have, dairy soup all the time. And many people have dairy soup, rarely. So if they say, no, last time I used this ladle for milchiks was a week ago, a month ago, three years ago, when Aunt Tilly made her dairy chicken, her potato soup. So then I say, well, the ladle got fleshik flavor, so ladle's a problem. Obviously, there's fresh chicken soup here. But the ladle, the milchik in the ladle, it wasn't no longer active. It was Eino Ben Yom. It was more than 24 hours old. So it is milchik, but it doesn't make anything else. Once the flavor stays for more than 24 hours, it retains its identity, but it can't impact anything else. So that's one of the major ideas that comes from here. There's more to talk about. We'll talk about countertops, we'll talk about microwaves, all sorts of other good stuff. Maybe we even talk about the steel scale if you have time. Thank you so much. I'm glad to stick around to see what you can call or email. And if there are other ideas you want for next week, feel free to throw it in the